House Committee on Judiciary. I apologize for the few-minute late start. We are going to try to keep that to a minimum. It's tough after the lunch hour, and I was down attending the Oregon Progress Board meeting that's occurring down in Measure or in Hearing Room 50. And I also will apologize in advance that at about 2 o'clock I'm going to need to step out for a few minutes along with Representative Shetterly to attend another meeting, and I'll give the gavel to Representative Ackerman. It is our intent today I believe, just have public hearings on the measures that are in front of us. Also want to point out that we will, for a short period of time, be without the company of Representative Jensen, who is going to be out of town. Well, technically out of town, but he's going to be out of pocket for a while as a result of some surgery that he's going to be having. And his legislative aide, Mr. Christensen, is here in the audience and will be monitoring the activities of the committee during Representative Jensen's absence. So with that, will anybody have anything before we get going? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I may have to leave at 3, so maybe I'll wield a fast gavel.
Well, and we and my hope is that
we still have another vice chair.
These will go quickly, and if you need to leave, then you can give it over to Representative Anderson on your way out. And at that point, we may not have a quorum, so there won't be much he can do.
It'll be informational anyway.
Yeah, right. Okay, we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2069.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2069 comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It deals with criminal appeals. It amends ORS 136.535, taking out the timing deadlines of that statute so that the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, which are already in that statute, would apply. This would give, I think it would change the time for a motion on these for an arrest of judgment, excuse me, or a new trial from 5 days to 10 days. And I hope that there's someone here to tell us about this.
There is. Susan Russell.
Of course not.
Good morning. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is our bill. I'd like to briefly take this opportunity to explain what it is that this bill is intended to do and some of the reasons and concerns that have given rise to it. HB 2069 extends the time in which a motion for a new trial may be filed in a criminal case so that it will be the same as a civil case. Under current law, a criminal motion for a new trial must be filed within 5 days. The state has 5 days to respond, and the motion must be heard within 20 days. If the motion is not heard and determined within 20 days after the judgment is entered, the motion is considered denied. Time limits for civil motions for a new trial are longer. The moving party has 10 days after judgment within which to file a motion for a new trial. The adverse party has 10 days to respond, and the court has 55 days within which to set a hearing and decide the motion. Preparing and investigating claims for a new trial can often take longer than the time that is currently allowed for motions for a new trial in a criminal case. There may be witnesses that need to be interviewed or located, evidence obtained. Sometimes new defense counsel is either substituted by the court or retained for sentencing, and they need additional time to familiarize themselves with the case. Court calendars are crowded. They are likely to become more crowded with budget cuts. It is difficult, may be difficult, for courts to find a time within their schedule, within a 20-day period of time, to set the motion for a new trial. It is a short time period. If the court is unable to schedule a motion for a new trial within the 20 days, from the time of judgment, the motion for new trial is deemed denied by statute. It is unclear whether the court has authority to extend the 20-day time limit for a hearing for a motion to new trial. It is not addressed in the statute. If a hearing is extended beyond the 20 days, there is a concern that has been raised that this may jeopardize the ability of a defendant to file an appeal by tolling or cutting into the 30-day time period in which a defendant has to file an appeal. Under the current schedule, with the 20 days within which to hear and determine a motion for a new trial, the court may have as little as 10 days to review filed materials. And in some cases, this is simply not an adequate amount of time. The grounds for a new trial in a criminal case are very limited. They are much more limited than issues that can be raised on appeal. Allowing a trial court to consider what really matters of fundamental errors and newly discovered evidence may save the cost of appeal and has a judicial efficiency to it. I'm
great.
Open for any questions.
Great. Are there questions for Ms. Russell? Yes, Representative Prusinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Russell, I guess the only question, I understand the bill is going to, would extend the current timeline by 5 days. Is there, and then you, in your testimony, you talked about whether or not the court has the ability to extend the 20-day time limit for the hearing. If I read the bill in its entirety, I don't think that you're attempting to address any type of change there. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prusinski. We're not. The answer is no, we're not. We're simply making the time frames the same as they are for a civil motion for a new trial. Under the statute, it's clear that the court has discretion both under the current motion for a new trial in criminal proceedings and in civil proceedings. The court has discretion to extend the time within which to file. What's unclear is whether the court has the ability to set over the outside length of period of time, 20 days in a criminal proceeding, and 55 days, and we're not asking for that to be changed.
Okay. I just want to make certain that the only thing you want to do is make this on the same time frame as the civil and still keep the other time frames, because it does seem like you'd potentially run into a problem with the other statute requiring any appeal to be filed within 30 days.
Incorrect. And we're not asking for that to be amended. The appellate provision with respect to the 30 days provides that the 30 days begins to run from the time at which the motion for new trial is either denied or the 20-day period of time at present has tolled. With the 55 days substituted for a 20-day, we feel that that would be adequate time for the matter to be considered.
Thank you. Further questions? Is there anyone else who intended to sign up to testify on this bill that's present here? Susan, I'm interested in you know, typically in a change like this, we would have someone here from, I would assume, sort of the other respective parties that would be potentially impacted or interested in this change, be it Department of Justice or the District Attorneys Association, and I don't see them here. Is that because you've reviewed this issue with them and they were in so much agreement they chose not to send anybody, or do you know?
I do not know.
Okay. Have you worked with any of those sort of usual suspects to get any kind of feedback on their position on this bill?
And not that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right. Curious.
This bill, I think, had arisen from some concerns with judges involved in criminal cases that had referred the matter, and I believe that that is how the original that our organization got involved in looking at this issue.
Right. Well, I mean, the idea of putting a new trial, I mean, it would be interesting to hear what the contrary, if there was a contrary view as to why, you know, not granting the same methodology and time frame in a criminal case as a civil case to sort of do the necessary legwork for a new trial request, why that would be opposed. At the same time, I'm always nervous about making what is a fairly significant sort of wholesale policy change on new trials in criminal cases, sort of when no one else has even come in to talk about it, which I don't mean to imply seems unfair to you, because it's not your job to make them show up and tell us about it. They're supposed to be monitoring this. But I just find it curious that they're not here. Well, okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
So staff's not had any contact or inquiry about this either?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, or excuse me, Representative Shirley, I spoke to Kevin Neely. I think they found out about it late. I don't think they had a, I read a couple emails. I don't know that they would support it, but I don't think it's registered. They know about it, and it's not a big problem, I don't think, from the Department of Justice. As far as the District Attorneys Association, I don't know. But I haven't had a full sit-down with them and see what they think.
Well, it's the kind of change also that it wouldn't surprise me to get some sort of feedback from the court potentially as
right.
well, who would be, since it's the judges who are primarily going to be operationally restricted by the change. And so I guess I'm hesitant to do anything else other than to say that we appreciate the testimony, and right now I'd say you're winning. but I think if there isn't anyone else here who wants to testify about the bill, but there are those people here who have their ears on listening for other people who might have wanted to think about testifying about this bill, that you should clearly get in touch with counsel. But we're going to delay, obviously, taking the bill into work session at this time. Are there any other questions for Susan?
And Mr. Chair, I'll do my best, too, to contact some of the individuals that may have been, with respect to the judiciary, that I'm aware of.
Sure. You might circle back and see if people are coming around on this issue. And if it's as easy as it sounds like it is this afternoon, then this should be a bill that would move quickly. But somehow I got this pit in my stomach, Susan, telling me that that's not probably how that's going to go. But if it is, I'm happy to see it that way. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2069. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2071. And you don't need to go very far, Susan. You can come right back. If you want to counsel, just give a brief outline. And then also at the same time, I'll call up Jonathan Fussner from the Department of Justice. We'll take both of you. You're the only two that have signed up on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House Bill 2071. Amends a statute that basically was created last session. Last session, Senate Bill 370 created a presumptive sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of release or parole for a person who's convicted on a third sentencing of a felony sex crime. And this measure would require the state to notify the defense of that fact. 30 days prior to trial, that the presumptive sentence is 30 days, the presumptive sentence is life without possibility of parole. There is if the state fails to so notify, the court can still impose the presumptive sentence, but must have good cause shown by the state for why they did not notify. I want to make a couple points. I handed out what the defined sex crimes are, and that's in ORS 181-594. I will note that this is an area where the statute only defines sex crime. This would only be for those felony sex crimes. If you're interested in which ones of these are felonies, we can go through it. I suggest maybe just talking to me about it because we can go through it in detail if you're interested. And secondly, I would also note that this is a presumptive life sentence. It is not a mandatory sentence, so that the judge could still depart if there were a cause for that and a basis.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Susan, thank you. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, Susan Russell again on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and this is also our bill. House Bill 2071 requires the state to notify the defendant of its intent to seek a life sentence upon conviction for a third felony sex offense. Last session, the legislature imposed a presumptive life sentence for a third felony sex offense conviction. In order for the defense to adequately prepare its case, it's necessary to know the presumptive sentence upon conviction. Currently, the state can seek a life sentence under the statute on a third felony sex offense without ever notifying the defense of its intention to do so. prior convictions are not always known to the defense. Sometimes they're not easy for the defense to learn about. They may be difficult to obtain and verify. Some out-of-state convictions qualify as a sex offense under this statute. Others do not. The standard is comparable offenses. A case would be handled and staffed differently by the defense if a life sentence was being sought by the state. More experienced attorneys may be assigned to the case. Perhaps more than one attorney would be assigned, which is often true in other life sentence cases, such as murder or aggravated murder. A case might also have a different outcome if the defendant was aware that the presumptive sentence was life. Some defendants might choose to resolve the case through a negotiated plea. Others might choose a trial. Requiring the state to notify the defense of the presumptive sentence of life may also avoid timely and expensive post-conviction proceedings. Post-conviction relief can be sought when the defense attorney fails to notify a defendant of a presumptive sentence in circumstances that may have affected or would have affected the defendant's decision-making in the case. If a plea, if a post-conviction proceeding succeeds, it may require that the case where a plea took place upon original disposition of the case, that a new trial be set years later, which can be very timely, very expensive. Witnesses may be absent, and again, this is an emotionally difficult area when we're talking about trying these cases, and may require trial in this context years later. If the state fails to notify for good cause, the remedy as provided by this amendment would be to allow the court to give an extension of time to the defense so that the defense could examine the issue and make whatever decisions would be appropriate under the case. It may very well be in many of these cases that a plea agreement can be worked out to avoid a particularly onerous life sentence. I would point out, I understand you've been handed, the committee's been handed a list of felony, of sex offenses, including misdemeanor and felony. But I believe actually most of the age difference offenses would qualify, for example, any age difference beyond 4 years would qualify as a felony sex offense. So when we're talking, with sometimes it may amaze people, defense or the defendant is not aware of his criminal history. We may be talking about an individual that's qualifying for a presumptive life sentence based solely on having two prior convictions that are of a relationship in which the three-year defense in terms of difference of age is exceeded. And sometimes in defendants' minds may be something that they believe has been expunged or no longer qualifies. So there are actually a number of complications in terms of determining what it is a defendant's criminal history that would qualify for these two prior convictions more than appear at first glance.
So to put it more bluntly, what you're suggesting is that if a person who was, say, 20, had had a consensual but illegal sexual relationship with a 15-year-old and had had two convictions for those such relationships, that that would qualify because it did fit within the age difference limitation of the felony sex offense. And on his third offense, if it were for any other qualifying offense, that could mean a presumptive life sentence.
That's correct.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and let Mr. Fussner testify, and then we'll do questions. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Oregon Department of Justice. The points very briefly that I wanted to make are simply a couple of matters that cause us concern about this bill and cause us to oppose it, at least in its present form. The chief objection is the district attorney simply may not know 30 days prior to trial whether a defendant has two qualifying prior sex crime convictions for felonies that qualify under the statute. It's, as has been already mentioned, sometimes difficult to track down out-of-state convictions convictions where the defendant has used an alias, and simply the records are often not available. And it puts something of a procedural roadblock, or you might even say a procedural trap, in the path of a prosecutor who is attempting to prosecute one of these cases. If the prosecutor either hasn't found out yet or simply fails to give the notice, gives the notice 29 days prior to trial instead of 30, for example, a defendant who otherwise would receive properly a life sentence is spared it. And that just strikes us as an unnecessary impediment to prosecution of these cases. I might point out that a defendant's prior criminal history is known to the defendant probably better than to anyone else, and is equally accessible to the defendant as it is to the state. There is no reason why a criminal defendant who's concerned about being in this position cannot do his own research and find out what his prior convictions are. The final point I would like to make is that the bill does not specify what happens if a district attorney fails to give this notice within 30 days. I assume that what happens is that the sentence then defaults to whatever the sentence would have been under the sentencing guidelines or under Measure 11, but I think it would be preferable if the bill spelled out specifically what does happen. Those are my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for either of the witnesses?
Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
It strikes me that this is really a version of a three-strike statute, and that's a trend that exists in elsewhere in the country. I'm wondering whether other jurisdictions that have three-strikes statutes, whether they're sex offenders or not, have any kind of notice requirement. How do they deal with the same issue? And I would put that to, I guess, to either of the witnesses, which whoever had might have knowledge about it.
Chair Williams, Representative McPherson, I do not know. I have not researched that issue. Perhaps you have.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I also am not aware whether that is drafted as this proposal is.
That would be a good question to get an answer to, the Representative, and maybe I see people writing, so I suspect we don't have an answer to that question. Representative Ackerman.
To each of the witnesses, Mr. Chairman, what is the status of current Oregon's case law regarding the pleading in an indictment of an aggravating circumstance for a sentence? I don't know. I have a feeling, but I need to know if you folks know.
Well, Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I can tell you that under Apprendi versus New Jersey, the United States Supreme Court case of, I think now, a couple of years ago, aggravating factors that elevate a crime to a higher level beyond the statutory maximum for the crime ordinarily have to be pleaded in the indictment and have to be proved to the jury, with one exception, and the exception is if the aggravating circumstance is a prior conviction. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no independent body of Oregon case law that has really dealt with that issue. There are a couple of cases, State versus Quinn and State versus Wedge, that are older Oregon Supreme Court cases. I don't think that they would take any position different from the United States Supreme Court on that issue. And so to try to shorten this answer up, I don't think that there would be a requirement for pleading these prior convictions or proving them to the jury because they don't fit within the Apprendi requirement.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I would agree with that also. I think the difference here is that when we're talking about those aggravating factors, they're actually an element or an element of a crime that would enhance the penalty. So, for example, to give you an Oregon example, a gun minimum, it would require that the state actually prove as a through the trial, either with a judge or jury, that the defendant, in fact, had used a firearm during the commission of the offense. So that's an actual factual element. This is also an enhancement provision, but it's an enhancement provision at sentencing.
counsel.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, I think the a good way to understand that is to compare it to felony DUII, where the convictions are part of an element of the crime. So this would be different from that, and then it's just a sentencing matter.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
And I think also sentencing guidelines, where you have the aggravating or mitigating scenarios, those do not have to be pled. That just basically comes in at
Correct.
Sentencing. But I do have a couple of questions, I guess. Jonathan, I was interested when you stated that the defendant, of course, the defendant pretty well knows what they've been before the court on and what they've been convicted. But unless my memory is short, I don't believe today that defense attorneys have access to NCIC or CCH records. I know for myself as a prosecutor, I have to actually sign that I will not release those in their entirety to anybody, and I have to just make my judgment based on what I have to share with them. I'm wondering if that's not the case.
I have to say that was not my impression, and I base that only on a case that I handled on appeal once a couple of years ago, in which it was stated in the record that the I think it was the public defender's office, as a indigent defense service provider, had access to those computerized criminal records. But I don't know the answer to that for sure.
Counsel? Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, in my experience as a prosecutor in Multnomah County, we would normally give a copy of the criminal history, saying the offense of the conviction, the date, and the county.
Right.
And that's what we would base it on, as opposed to the computers. I don't know if that's what your experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's my understanding, is that it's the burden is on the prosecutor to provide this information, and I just want to make sure the record is clear that my understanding, the defense attorneys do not have the ability to actually tap into those computer records, and that we're basically are limited as to giving them actual copies, but we do make representations based on our review of those records.
It seems to me, and I'll lay this out as just sort of a general statement and then get any response from either of the witnesses, but on the one hand, it seems to me there's the issue of the fairness that to the extent that you're talking about a presumptive life sentence, that giving the defense notice that that's what they're going to be seeking, whether it's 30 days or at some point in advance of the actual hearing, would make sense, if not only from the fairness with respect to the defendant who now has a potential life sentence situation confronting them, but also if we're talking again about resource management, and I don't try to bring everything back to that subject matter, but if we're talking about resource management, if you're handling the case on the defense side and you know that there is a possibility of a presumptive life sentence, you at that point begin to have an obligation to prepare for it as if that is the thing that they're going to seek, because your failure to do so puts you at risk of not providing a proper defense of that person. And yet if they're not intending to seek that, you're wasting resources preparing for the defense of a very serious issue of a presumptive life sentence, when it may not be the best use of your resources because they're not potentially going to seek that. So somewhere in the midst of this, it seems to me that both from a fairness and an appropriateness of level of defense preparation, it would make sense to provide some sort of notice to the defendant if the DA was going to intend to seek that. Now, I'm cognizant of Mr. Fussner's comment that given the hurly-burly of criminal cases, both from the side of the district attorney's office and the timing of these events with respect to a court calendar, that they might not know 30 days in advance whether or not that's the decision. And I'm worried also by the remedy that's proposed here if it means that they can never go back to that issue. But some level of delay or other procedure would seem appropriate. Mr. Fussner, do you want to comment on that?
The only comment I would have, Chair Williams, is that I'm not aware that there has been a problem with judges affording criminal defendants a sufficient amount of time to prepare for trial, to consider plea offers, to prepare for sentencing. And this strikes me as something that's appropriate for judges to handle on a case-by-case basis. And if a defendant says, well, you know, I still don't know if I have those qualifying priors, I need more time to investigate that, or the district attorney isn't telling me and he's dragging his feet, or it's a surprise to everyone, it's suddenly come up at sentencing, first we heard about it, I would think that a judge could could handle that by simply saying how much more time do you need, or something along that line, rather than setting what I view as a bit of a landmine here for the prosecutor who just by happenstance or by mistake fails to give this notice 30 days in advance of trial and then is forever in that case prohibited from seeking the sentence authorized by law that this person deserves to get.
Counsel.
I'm curious for both Mr. Fussman and Ms. Russell. When I read this, specifically lines 19 and 20, it doesn't say anything about what the state is intending to seek. It just says they shall notify of the presumptive sentence so that if the state decided to depart and go below life sentence and thought it did not, the case did not merit such a sentence, they'd still have to technically, by the statute, notify that this is the presumptive sentence. Would you agree?
Yes, that's correct. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, adding on the, this issue of fairness, where this arose from, this concern, rather than the district attorneys being unwilling or unable, I think that the concern from the defense perspective is that there have been a number of cases, a very new statute in the last, since it's gone into effect, there have been cases where the state, had the state reviewed the matter, would have been aware from the record that the individual, the defendant, qualified for a presumptive life sentence, but simply was either unaware of the life provision or wasn't focused on it, particularly when dealing with what we've commonly referred to as these sort of statutory sex offenses. That can be particularly an issue in a district attorney's mind where you're dealing with some behavior, perhaps, which is not considered perhaps the most extreme in terms of a sexual offense. It may be assigned to a unit within the district attorney's office that isn't handling the most serious offenses, and the district attorney who is actually dealing with the case may not even be focused on this issue. And this has happened on cases that I know have been handled in the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office where I'd worked previously, and in other offices that are dealing with sort of a large quantity caseloads where these types of cases tend to be assigned.
Follow-up. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Russell, follow-up. As a defense attorney, would you go over a plea petition, a written plea petition that you certify that you went over with a defendant before they enter a plea, for example, if say there was a negotiation? You would, right?
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. McKay, I would do that.
And on that, you would inform them of the maximum sentences.
And
possible.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
And if the defense attorney failed to mention that, say in a plea situation, not a trial situation, wouldn't that would be ineffective counsel, basically, wouldn't it?
That's correct. And I discussed earlier, it could give rise to a post-conviction proceedings. This is a very new statute, so I'm not aware that any cases have arisen to this level. But I can let you know in a very similar area, which involves less aggravated criminal histories and often less aggravated offenses, we refer to as the Denny Smith provision, which has actually been around for quite a period of time. It is often, I wouldn't say fairly common, but it's a more common than average grounds on which defendants do file post-conviction proceedings and succeed, simply by the defense attorney's inadvertent failure to notify the defendant that they did qualify for the Denny Smith provision that required that they do the full sentence and were not eligible for other work reductions or good time credits that the defendant would have believed he was entitled to and relied on in making a decision whether or not to enter and accept a plea that had been offered. So that is an area where there has been quite a bit of litigation in which that very specific issue has been raised and addressed.
Yes, Representative Przanski.
I'm wondering, kind of thinking about outside the box, hearing where Mr. Fussman is as to the position from the appellate perspective. I'm not sure if you would feel comfortable answering where the trial attorney may be, but if the defense asked by letter whether the state was going to be seeking this type of sanction, how do you think that would be handled? I mean, to me, it seems like they would be an obligation to state where the state stood on sentencing. Do you think that would be a way that maybe it would give notice to the defense without maybe going through this type of requirement through statute? Just by making a written request whether or not they're going to be seeking that type of sentence.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinesky, I'm not... I guess my response is that we're sort of putting the burden on the defense in a position where they have very limited access, or certainly much reduced access to gathering this information or assessing whether this is even an issue than it would as currently drafted. In discussing earlier the issue of whether or not defense attorneys do have access to criminal records, search vehicles, in my experience, they do not. So I think that is sort of reversing sort of the burden in this type of proceeding, and would not be able to protect the rights we're seeking to protect as effectively.
See, if I could just intercede here, and then we're going to close the public hearing and move on. The issue that, on the one hand, if you say that you have to say it or you'll never be able to assert it at the time of the sentencing, will mean that the DAs will always assert it. Whether or not they actually intend to seek it or not, they'll send notice that they're going to do it because that's the only way they can protect the possibility that they might want to do it in the future, so it'll become sort of a matter of course. And that'll put you guys in the position of having to treat every single case as if you're going to have to defend against it. And I think, in my mind, that's not the most efficient way to handle this. It would seem to me that if they're really going to seek it, they ought to have to tell you that they're really going to seek it, and then you can really prepare to defend as if they're really seeking it. And to the extent that there are cases where they're not really going to seek it, you don't have to do the same level of defense preparation, and it's not so much trial by escalation or ambush, which is, I think, what we're trying to avoid here. So I'm going to ask you and Mr. Fussner and Counsel Prinz and the mysterious representative in the center chair from the District Attorneys Association to sit down together and have a conversation about a way to potentially resolve this bill in an issue with the efficiency, both the fairness and the efficiency issue being sort of forefront in the part of the discussion. Is that acceptable to everybody?
Very much so. We'll work on that.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing. Okay, we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2072. And we would ask Mr. Barnes Ellis, Chair of the Public Defense Services Commission, to come forward.
Mr. Chair, if I could suggest, could we combine 2072 with 2073?
We have that ability. 2074. Yeah. Right? 2074. Yeah. I'll open at the same time a public hearing on House Bill 2074 and ask Peter Ozan, Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services, to come forward.
And if we could indulge one other request, could we have Ann Christian also at table, because sometimes you have questions and she's the best informed.
Please welcome Ann. Mr. Ellis, please proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. I'm chair of the Public Defense Services Commission. This was a commission formed as a result of SB 145 passed by the 2001 Legislative Assembly. The bill creating the commission called for it to assume responsibility immediately of the State Public Defender's Office and then to assume at a later date, which was set as October 1 of 03, responsibility for the Indigent Defense Program. The State Public Defender's Office has been in existence since the mid-1960s, and it was formed as a FTE lawyer-staffed group to provide appellate services in indigent cases. Over time, of course, we have seen a significant evolution in defense services. And the IDP group, which has been a subset of the State Court Administrator's Office, has been responsible for managing the indigent defense account through contracts with providers to provide both defense services at the trial level in criminal cases, also in juvenile dependency and neglect cases, also in probation cases and in mental commitment cases. The 01 legislation addressed the concern that this fragmented, bifurcated system was not the most efficient way to go, and there also were a number of issues relating to the judges and their role in the defense process. So the new legislation called for appointment by the Chief Justice of a commission to oversee a combination of these two agencies, and I've been privileged to be chair of that. The Chief Justice himself is a non-voting member of the commission. He has appointed seven commissioners, and in my written testimony, I give you some background on the membership. The commission has been a very active group. We've had 15 full commission meetings since we were formed in August of 01. And part of our process has been a recognition that critical to our ability to assume responsibility for both of these functions was to bring on board the right person as executive director. The 01 legislation really didn't contemplate that happening until the end of this biennium, but we thought it was very important, if we could possibly do so, to find funding from existing sources and to conduct a search and bring that person on. I was here last week, and you all know Peter Ozan. We're very happy that he was available and that he emerged as a consensus candidate for that job. That being in place, we're very pleased to say that we think we're ready to accelerate the cutover date. And instead of deferring a quarter into the next biennium, which would involve stub period accounting and a delay in what we all think of as the benefits of this new structure, which we are optimistic will both improve quality and cost effectiveness, we would like to see accelerated the date that the IDP piece would come in. We've had a transition team that has really been terrific, both including people from the State Court Administrator's Office, and I want to particularly commend Kingsley Click, who has been very cooperative in trying to help us put this together. Jeff Guilfoy, who many of you know, has acted as a consultant, and Christian and David Groom have both been very active in this process. And we think we're ready to do it, and we think the benefits are ones that ought not to be delayed, and the element of caution that the last legislature injected of postponing that, I think we're at a point now that we're ready to proceed, and with the due pass recommendation on this legislation, we're optimistic we can do so.
Are there questions for Mr. Ellis about House Bill 2072? As you pointed out, colleagues, all this does is accelerate the date to July from October to make it all come out even at the end of the biennium, as opposed to having that carry over into the next biennium. They were given the time initially in the bill because people thought it might take that time, to, and we didn't want to push them. They've obviously achieved that ahead of schedule, and we ought to, I think, help them move that forward. Is there any discussion, any questions? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2072 and open a work session on House Bill 2072. Colleagues, you should be aware that this bill, because of the nature of the fiscal transfers associated with this, has a referral to the Ways and Means Committee. So this bill will not go directly from this committee to the floor, but will have a stop in Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I recall my motion. I think it would be to move House Bill 2072 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
That is, in fact, the motion. Representative Shetterly moves that House Bill 2072 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill will move, and we will show Representative Jensen as permanently excused until he comes back. We are still in public hearing on House Bill 2074. Mr. Ozan.
Chairman Williams, Peter Ozan, Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services, here to request your consideration and approval of House Bill 2074, which was introduced at the request of the Public Defense Services Commission. It has the support of the Oregon Judicial Department, and as far as we know, there is no opposition to the bill. As Mr. Barnes has mentioned to you, in 2001, the Legislative Assembly established the Public Defense Services Commission, to which I report. And House Bill 2074 is really, I guess, what would be characterized as housekeeping, or provides provisions to increase the commission and the Office of Public Defense Services' ability to operate. There are really three components that I've listed in the written testimony to House Bill 2074. First is the potential composition of the Public Defense Services Commission. In order to tap the talent and perspective of the Judicial Department, and judges in particular, the bill would authorize senior judges, that is, judges who don't have a regular caseload or place to sit but are still in the judiciary, to be on the commission. And to avoid both the appearance and reality of conflict of interest, the bill would prohibit anyone who is primarily engaged in providing public defense services to indigents, prohibiting them from serving on the commission. The second area of House Bill 2074 is what I've referred to as essentially housekeeping functions. For example, as a agency in the judicial branch, to make it clear that the agency is not subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, references in the bill to rules have been changed to policies, procedures, and guidelines. One other important provision, though, as a manager of the Office of Public Defense Services, which I'd want to do anyway, is bring our personnel policies and classification system into alignment with other state agencies. So the bill does direct the Office of Public Defense Services to establish a personnel classification system. And the third category is what we've listed as other substantive changes. As executive director, I'm obligated to report annually to the commission. This isn't an effort to just reduce my work, but presently I have an obligation to report to you annually, and this legislation contemplates the notion that we would track more of the schedule of the legislature by making my obligation to you to report biennially. However, we would have annual reports if any interested member wanted to see those. Another area that is of significance is the non-routine fees and expenses, sometimes noted as or extraordinary expenses, and this legislation makes clear that any fees or expenses be pre-authorized by our office. The current legislation simply says that that would be permissive. You may seek pre-authorization. This requires it and also provides provisions to appeal the office's determination of pre-authorization to the circuit court. So absent questions from the committee, that's all I have. Thank you for your attention.
Are there questions for Mr. Ozan about this bill? Representative Crummell.
I just have, and this is just a curiosity question, why not have the ability to have one member of the commission be a public defender?
Well, you know, offhand, I don't see any particular objection other than the notion of apparent interest in the outcome. That's why one of the reasons we had Ann Christian come up. She is familiar with what we call the legislative history, at least the discussion on the commission. Do you have a better answer than that, if I may, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, there was a commission that was formed to study the issue of indigent defense prior to the last legislative session, and this was an issue that study commission looked at and that the current permanent commission has looked at.
And I guess I would say, based upon a number of discussions, and the chair of the commission clearly can correct me, my sense is at this point in time, with the commission being relatively new, and the mandate that, quite frankly, has been given to the commission, at least at this point in time, it's the commission's feeling that it's best not to even have an appearance of some type of conflict of interest. Based upon what I've seen from this commission, something that they've decided today, after some ability to really get their hands around the bigger part of this program, I can see them potentially reconsidering that in the future.
Yes, Mr. Ellis.
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell. I'd add a couple of comments. One is we are benefited in the composition of the commission today with a number of people who have a great deal of background in that field. John Potter, for example, is executive director of the OCDLA, so he's very much in touch with the defense community. I personally served for 30 years as chair of Metropolitan Public Defenders, which is the largest nonprofit trial-level defense provider agency in the state, all on contract. Sean McCrae is vice chair of the commission, and she's a well-respected member of the defense bar. So I don't think we're deprived from input people that are knowledgeable. Secondly, we have made it a practice of the commission to have our meetings not just open, but we have had in attendance at those meetings a number of people from the defense provider community, and we invite their input on virtually everything that we do. But we felt, and I personally felt, that it was important that the commission not in any way be looked upon as people that benefited from financially from the decisions that we make. So I personally have supported the separation, and we pay a price for it, but I think the price is well worth it to maintain not just the fact of integrity and separation, but not just the appearance, but also the fact of it.
Further questions? Colleagues, you'll note that in the staff measure summary, it also lists a series of bills that the commission is exempt from as they are currently, as the office is currently exempt as part of the judicial branch. This, again, is the housekeeping portion of the measure that Mr. Ozan referred to that simply maintains their current exemption from those statutory provisions, as is the judicial branch, because they remain under the operation with the Chief Justice as the appointing authority of the judicial branch. And I'd note that we in the legislature are equally immune from those very same sets of statutes. So that gives you an idea of sort of how this works. I wanted to point that out for you for purposes of the bill. Are there any further questions? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2074. Open a work session. This bill also has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and look surprised by my saying that.
I just find it interesting, Mr. Chair.
As do I, and we can certainly find out more about it and why that might be. But and let me do this. We're in a work session. We don't have to necessarily move the bill, and if you would prefer, because once I've moved it, I can't necessarily get it back easily. So if you would prefer, we can close the work session and we can hold on to the bill while we do some legwork to determine what the theory behind a Ways and Means referral would be. Because the nature of this bill is, in fact, housekeeping, it doesn't seem to me to have a fiscal impact.
I would appreciate that, Mr. Chair, if you could hold off on...
Would you prefer then with that? I frankly think that's a good idea as well, but I don't want to slow the process up. So with that, we'll close the work session, and we'll keep a hold of this bill long enough to figure out the story behind the Ways and Means referral, and it may just be that the bills were sort of together in the packet, and it seemed like the right thing to do. So we'll do some more investigation on that.
And, Mr. Chair, then with your permission, I'll be in contact with counsel and... let you know what I find out, and perhaps we could have the matter scheduled then for a work session in the near future.
Yes, and I'll make the same inquiry through the Speaker's office to make that determination. The other bill will go to the Public Safety Sub, and so I'd encourage you, obviously, to begin conversations with Representative Patridge, who chairs that subcommittee. And he and I are going to be meeting on a fairly regular basis, at least weekly, to sort of review our schedules together, and I'll make this an order of business to discuss with them as well. So with that, we are going to move on to the next two bills. Again, I apologize that I have another meeting in legislative revenue that unavoidably conflicts, and so I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative Ackerman, who will administer the hearing on the last two bills on the agenda today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2095. I have two witnesses, Karen Berkowitz and Ronell Schenkel. Welcome again. Pardon? Yeah, okay. I believe Ms. Schenkel is the sponsor of the bill, so we'll hear from you first, please. And might want to keep in mind, I have a commitment to testify before a committee at 3 this afternoon, and upon my departure, we may lack a quorum.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support, here today in support of House Bill 2095. Perhaps in the interest of time, let me tell you what you're receiving by way of handouts. And rather than walking you through the bulleted information, I'll hit some highlights and leave time for questions and other witnesses. This bill is related to the Child Support Program and a federal mandate, which is the National Medical Support Notice. What it is striving to do briefly is take the existing child support federal regulations and then our state laws and strengthen them for purposes of enforcing health care coverage for dependent children. I'll speak to a few of the major changes, but what you will find in your handouts are basically, and in the bill itself, that we're repealing the existing law, which is 25255, and pretty much doing a rewrite in an attempt to make the new law clear to those that will be reading it. Some of the significant points, this is, as I mentioned, a federal mandate bill, and you should also be noting in the back of your materials, if you will, or I apologize, it may be an additional handout. We have a one-page penalty document that explains to you how the child support program is funded, how our state plan compliance issues are laid out, and what occurs in the state of Oregon if we do not pass our federally mandated regulations. And I can speak more to that if you wish me to do so. But back to the bill itself. Briefly, some of the changes that you will see represented here are as follows. One of the significant pieces is the National Medical Support Notice itself. It is a 12-page federally mandated form. The good news is all of the state child support programs are mandated to use it, so there will be one form that all of the employers and all the health plan administrators are seeing from all of our child support programs. The bad news is it's a 12-page form and it's federally mandated, so it may not have the exact language that Oregon would choose, but our program will do everything we can to make it understandable and workable for the employers and the health plan administrators. One of the other significant pieces with this legislation is that under current laws, when the child support program is attempting to enforce medical support health care coverage for children, we are able to issue orders to employers and cause them to enroll the children in the health plan if it is so ordered and if that plan is available. One of the hurdles, and I'm way simplifying this at the moment, but would be happy to answer more technical questions. One of the hurdles that we encounter with the current laws is that if an obligor, if the noncustodial parent himself or herself has not chosen to enroll in an insurance plan, there is no way at the current time that we can force that enrollment, and therefore are, the children will never be enrolled. So even though there is an order, we do have a barrier in place. This would change that. This law would strengthen, should we adopt it in our statutes, our ability to cause that obligor to be enrolled in order to enroll the dependent children. So we would no longer have that barrier of having an order for health plan coverage but no ability to enforce it. So that is another significant piece related to the enforcement. There are, I will not hide it from you, there are some federally mandated time frames that will be new for employers and for health plan administrators. The federal regulations do instruct us, and you will see in the draft, that when we send out this new notice from the program, the employers have 20 days from that notice to provide certain information, and basically they're either going to tell the child support program this is no longer our employee, or they're going to confirm that that is still an employee and forward on the appropriate information to the health plan administrator. The health plan administrator then has 40 days from that original notice to provide the program with certain information, whether or not the health plans are available, and and if there are multiple plans, they will provide information to the program so we can help determine which plan the children will be enrolled in. So there are some time frames built in. For the program, we also have some time frames built in. Not only will we issue this notice whenever we come across new information about an obligor's employer, but based on the mandates, within 2 days of any employer reporting notice, and there are laws in Oregon that you will find in Chapter 25 that instruct all employers to report new hires and rehires to the child support program. So any of that information we receive, within 2 days, we must generate this notice. The intent here, obviously, is that we get the information out and begin enforcement of these provisions as quickly as possible. Those are some of the real highlights, and I do not intend to overlook anything important or significant. As you will see in the background, I walk through each section of the bill where there are either significant changes or perhaps not new changes. We may have rewritten the language, but I wanted to make sure you were aware what the language was relating to and where you could find it in the current law. I also want to point out that this, as with many of our federally mandated child support laws, is fairly technically complex, and the program is still in process of meeting with various partners and receiving comments from partners such as Legal Aid Services. And so we do anticipate and have given Chair Williams a heads up that we would like to have some amendments to this bill in the future to make sure that the law is as clear as it can be to everyone who has to use it, including the families, and that it is technically in compliance. So I will leave my comments at that point and open it up for questions. Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee? President Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification. So if I'm working for an employer who doesn't offer insurance, then there's no way you can enforce that. Well, at least from that employer. I mean, I guess you could try to make me buy insurance.
Vice Chair Ackerman and Chair Barker, I missed an important piece, perhaps, of education related to health insurance. There's a much earlier part of establishing child support orders where there is terminology you will see in the definition section that says, first of all, whether or not we determine that health care coverage will be ordered, we must find out, is it available through an employer or union, and isn't it reasonable in cost, and is it accessible to the child? A key point there is accessible to the child. That is a new provision that we don't currently have in Oregon law. So in your scenario, we most likely would not have been able to order insurance. Had you had it available at the time and you've changed employers and now it's not available, you're correct, we would not be able to enforce it at this time, but we would continue to seek information and work with you in order to find ways to do so.
Yeah, follow up. Thank you. And the mandate, I'm guessing, like, for example, here as a state representative, I wouldn't have to take the insurance. So if I'm with my third wife who has insurance, and I opted not to take it, is just in a spiteful way to not have to provide for the child. This way you could say, no, you can't do that. I would have to take the employer-provided insurance and insure the child.
Vice Chair Ackerman and Chair Barker, at the time that we're establishing, we will look at the availability of insurance both through the obligor and the obligee to find out where the options are. Should it be available, for instance, in your scenario, then in all likelihood we would have ordered it against you as the obligor and would then seek to enforce it.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee, counsel?
Ms. Shankle, looking at the law now, I take it we have 25.255 now requires that you provide health care insurance, and that's if they're just under your system, or does that apply to everyone?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Mr. Taylor, that is in the current law, and it exists in this bill as well. It is not just for child support program and administrative law, but it is all orders entered in Oregon, and you will see that in one of the sections there is a whole string of basically all of the statutes that refer to the entry of orders that have child support provisions, and everyone shall order it when available with these new definitions, when it is accessible and reasonable in cost.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Vice Chair? This is the first bill to come before us in which I have any even remotely relevant for practice experience, so it is probably a dangerous thing. But I recall encountering in the past there's a provision of federal law that identifies qualified medical child support orders and requires if there's a court, and this may be out of date statement of what the law, as I recall it, is that if there is a court order but not an agency order, then an employer that receives such an order is bound then to extend coverage to the child of one of its employees. And I want to see whether I'm reciting that element of the law and see how that relates to what is going on here. Am I right so far then in my understanding of the current state of federal law as it relates to this program is?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson, I probably should begin by saying, by the way, although I am with the Department of Justice, I'm not an attorney, so I will not contradict you on what you said, although I have a slightly different understanding. The qualified medical child support order still exists. We've picked up that language from the existing law and moved it into this bill, so it will still be found there as the ability for the court to issue such an order to enforce insurance. Where I might slightly differ or perhaps misunderstood you is whether or not the underlying child support order was entered by the program in administrative law or entered by a circuit court, the child support program has the ability and the duty to provide enforcement services for all types of orders, and regardless of where that original order was taken, we, through the program services, will still use this new national medical support notice to enforce it. If the parties privately went to court and the court was seeking to use a remedy, they would still issue the qualified medical child support orders that you're referring to rather than the national medical support notice.
Okay, but if I may have follow up?
May.
A point of tension, at least at one point in the history, and I think the field probably has evolved beyond my personal experience with it, is that it was a distinction between agency orders as opposed to court orders, and under this legislation it would appear that an agency order would be sufficient without the parties having to go to court, that an agency could enter an order as a support enforcement agency, quite aside from whether or not the parents of the child, or say a parent who didn't have access to coverage could, under the system I was referring to, seek coverage from the other parent. And it sounds like this would extend fully then agency authority to compel coverage at the agency's initiative without any involvement from either parent.
Vice Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one more time around, I want to make sure that I understand this correctly. Would a person ordered to provide coverage have to provide the coverage even if it was not part of employment, if it was not part of their employment?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Crummell, there are actually several options. It may be ordered in their child support order. The provisions may say that they're ordered to cover the dependents through health care, through an employer or union. We may order, as I mentioned earlier, that the obligee or the custodial parent is going to do so, or they may agree to some other alternative arrangement. There are times when the parents will agree that getting a plan outside of employment is more accessible, is more reasonable in cost. So there are actually three options on the table. But should the order say that that obligated parent shall carry it through their employer or union, then we will take steps to enforce that terminology unless and until that's modified.
But what, follow up, Mr. Chair. But what if the employer does not offer a health insurance benefit?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Crummell, if they do not offer and the order instructed us to enforce it, we would not have an enforcement remedy available, and we would monitor that case until such time that it became available, or we may look at a modification of that underlying order to have more appropriate provisions for that family in place.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Very well.
And this can be rather quickly, but I'm a little bit concerned about the ability of the summary, it states that it permits the court or the agency to issue medical child support order or notice requiring obligor's employer or union to enroll child in a health benefit plan. So if it was not part of the child support order, basically this bill would give the agency the opportunity to say, well, we think that Mr. Barker should have to provide health insurance for his child, and so we're going to order him to pay irrespective of what the court said. Am I reading that correctly?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Crummell, no, that is not the intent of that language in my summary, and I apologize if it is misleading. The only time that the child support program would be able to take the enforcement steps that I've been speaking to is if the underlying order, whether that was an administrative order or a court order, the underlying order itself called for health insurance coverage by the obligor. When those provisions are there, then we have a responsibility in the program to enforce them. But we cannot simply issue a national medical support notice and begin enforcing without having an order that gives us the authority to do so.
And one more question, Mr. Chair. And an administrative order is issued by whom?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Crummell, administrative orders are issued by enforcing offices within the child support program, so either Department of Justice, Division of Child Support staff, or County District Attorney staff, and that is done using the Chapter 416 provisions of administrative child support laws. They ultimately are filed in circuit court and basically become orders with the same force and effect as the judicial orders.
So it's an order, Mr. Chair, if I may. So it's an order that is written by the administrative arm, but then ratified by the court. Am I hearing that correctly?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Crummell, ratified may be too strong of a word. Basically, the administrative process is intended to be an expedited process. It is outside the judicial arena at the point that we're in proceedings. Lots of due process built in so that both mothers and fathers receive legal notices, have the opportunity for administrative hearings through the hearings officer panel, and ultimately appeals to the circuit court if at the end of all of that process they still do not agree with the agency actions. But at the point that final order is signed by representative of the administrator, it goes to court and it's filed. It does not receive actual review and ratification at that time. It is subject to appeal and review by the court, but they aren't all approved, so to speak.
Yeah, one more, Mr.
You may.
With your indulgence. Thank you.
Please.
So if there's a negotiated settlement that doesn't include health care insurance, can the administrative arm step in and say, you got everything right, accept this, and we're going to order health care benefit be provided by pick one?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Crummell, if there were, for instance, a stipulated order that had been entered in the court, we would be enforcing the provisions of that order. If there were new circumstances that caused the program to believe that the order should be reviewed, for instance, in your scenario, perhaps the custodial parent had to put the children on the Oregon health plan, so in essence the state was providing insurance because of the needs of the family, it may be appropriate for the agency to initiate a modification action to look at whether or not insurance would be available through the obligor. But again, that would be a full legal process initiated under the administrative statutes with opportunity for hearings and so on built in. We could not simply say there are missing provisions and we're going to change them or enforce them. We would have to go through a legal process first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Further questions from the committee? Counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Schenkel, it may help to give a little bit of a breakdown. You represent people where there is aid to dependent children involved, is that correct?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Mr. Taylor, that is correct. Basically, the Division of Child Support receives our cases when the children either are receiving welfare, Oregon Health Plan benefits, they're in foster care, or they're in juvenile care. So the state has an interest in illegal action.
And those are the cases that go through the administrative process and procedure?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Mr. Taylor, that is correct. The Division of Child Support almost exclusively uses the administrative process.
And is that process subject to the Administrative Procedures Act?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Mr. Taylor, portions of our process are subject to that act, and in other areas of our law, we have specifically laid out the process as it relates to child support.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could ask one or two more basic questions, too. And you mentioned that you go to the circuit court from there. Is that for a de novo hearing? So the person who's gone through the administrative process, if they so choose, could go to circuit court and ask the circuit court judge to hear the issue again.
Mr. Ackerman and Mr. Taylor, that is correct.
Which differs from most administrative proceedings where it's usually to the Court of Appeals, where it's a review just of the legal issues.
Mr. Ackerman and Mr. Taylor, that is also correct.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I have just a few follow-up questions because I was somewhat concerned how this process fits into the traditional divorce setting, and I understand the question has been brought out here. Basically, there's two ways you get your orders. Either we go through a contested case administrative procedure hearing, or an order can emanate from a court trial arising out of a child custody, child support type case. Referring to the latter, I think it's been fairly clearly stated how the administrative orders rise to the level of circuit court. But I'm wondering, how do you shoehorn this process into a traditional divorce case where you're having a custody issue and a support issue? And that would be number one. And my second question would be, I want to get clear why existing law does not cover us, and that I'm familiar with many, many court orders that do require a custodial, non-custodial parent to provide medical insurance for the subject children. That's really two questions.
Mr. Ackerman, there are a myriad of services, but when it comes to the divorce decrees, it is very common that the decrees themselves today contain language that instructs the child support program to begin providing enforcement services once that decree is entered. So it is common that within our caseload, we are actually enforcing divorce decrees that were taken outside of our process initially by the parties in circuit court, but then we would use these same remedies to enforce the health care provisions. If they are not being sent to our program for services at that time, either of the parties at any time can apply for services to the program. Child support program services are free to the citizens of Oregon. They simply need to apply through a simple one-page form. If they're completely outside of our services and not receiving, therefore, enforcement through this new proposed law, it is possible for the court to issue one of those qualified medical child support orders to enforce the health care provisions, which Representative McPherson was referring to earlier. Did I answer both of your questions?
Yes, so. All right. And now, if I understand, there would be an adjustment of child support once the obligation for insurance was determined. Wouldn't that force the traditional people in a divorce situation to go back post-decree and post-judgment and work out another support order?
Vice Chair Ackerman, in the statutes you will find, they are referenced in this bill, but elsewhere in Chapter 25, that all orders entered in Oregon, whether you're in the administrative process or the judicial arena before the court, are subject to the use of the Oregon Child Support Guidelines. And those guidelines are found in a whole series of administrative rules. So the assumption would be that at the time of the divorce decree, the judge is using those guidelines, and part of the guidelines does instruct them that if health care coverage is being ordered, they shall allow a pro rata credit, and they calculate that into the obligation at that time. Later, should we be enforcing that divorce decree through the program and there are changes taking place related to the insurance and the costs, it might be appropriate for a modification to occur so that we can make sure that that credit is in place and reflects what's actually happening for the family.
Okay. I think my second question, why is existing law inadequate? Is it because we cannot compel the enrollment of the children in the health plan?
Vice Chair Ackerman, if you look to the federal materials, and we've provided a copy to the Chair and Mr. Taylor, I did not copy them for all of you because they're rather lengthy and we're trying to save some paper, but you will find a couple of key points. One is that it does increase the enforcement ability of child support programs in areas where we have been lacking. But the other significant piece of what you will see referenced in those materials is that the federal government heard quite clearly from the states that there was some need for uniformity, that employers dealing with all the various states' laws and ways of enforcing health care coverage was a burden on the employers and the health plan administrators, so they're striving to have one national model that we all use to lessen that burden.
Okay, thank you. Further questions from the committee? All right, proceed with Ms. Berkowitz, please.
Thank you. Vice Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Karen Berkowitz. I'm an attorney with Legal Aid Services of Oregon, and I'm testifying on behalf of our clients who are low-income Oregonians. We do represent both the obligors and obligees in child support cases, though hopefully not the same case. We support this bill and understand that it is an issue of federal compliance, but we do have some concerns with the detail in the bill. The first point, and I have the points highlighted in my written testimony, we believe that the authority to issue a medical support notice should be extended past the child support agency to private litigants so that they don't have to go through the child support agency to get this notice issued and get these kinds of enforcement services. My second point is that throughout the bill, there are some inconsistencies between when the plan administrator or the employer has to provide certain documentation to the obligee or the custodial parent. Sometimes the custodial parent is included in the chain of documents, and sometimes the obligee is omitted. And because of the importance of medical insurance and getting this information, we would like to ensure that in every situation, the plan administrator or the employer has to provide the necessary documentation directly to that custodial parent as well as to the agency. I think it's particularly important when it comes to the plan itself and the description of benefits, and you'll see in the bill that they talk about plans, situations where the obligor may have multiple plans available. Then in that situation, it's very critical that the obligee get the information quickly to be able to go over it and make certain decisions. One of the things this bill does is it repeals ORS 25255 subsection 2, and that section provides that each party shall bear a pro rata share of the medical costs, and that goes into the child support guideline calculation. I'm not sure why that provision came out of the bill, but I suggest that either that be kept in the bill or some other language added which will specifically provide that each party shall bear the pro rata share of the cost of providing medical insurance. That's the way it's currently done in the guidelines, but without specific statutory mandates, obviously the guidelines can change at any time. And we think that it's the fairest way of doing things to allocate the cost of medical insurance between the parents based on their relative incomes. Section 3 of the bill talks about obligors who maintain insurance and obligees who maintain insurance, and there's a difference in treatment. The obligor who maintains insurance is subject to a reasonable cost and accessibility requirement, whereas the obligee isn't, and we believe that those requirements should be uniform, whether the custodial parent or the non-custodial parent maintain insurance. Also, in Section 6, there's a discussion of who has the right to choose the medical insurance if there are multiple plans available. And this bill provides that the child support agency makes that choice, and we feel very strongly that within the parameters of cost and accessibility, if there are several plans that meet those requirements, it should be the custodial parent that makes that election. Section 7 talks about the medical support order and the amount withheld under that not exceeding the Federal Consumer Protection Act limits. And that's really unclear whether that's intended to apply to the medical support enforcement part alone or a combination of the child support order plus the medical support order. Obviously, because the Consumer Credit Protection Act allows a withholding of up to 65% of net income, we would hope that we look at the combination of the cost of the medical insurance to the party maintaining it and the amount of child support that that party is obligated to pay as well. And I would like to point out that Oregon has chosen to limit child support withholding to 50%, which is lower than the Consumer Credit Protection Act. So I'd like you to consider whether the combination of the medical support order and the child support order should also be subject to that limit. Section 8 deals with due process rights if the obligated parent disagrees with something in the support order. What it does is it leaves out the obligee, the custodial parent, in the scenario. In most cases, the obligee is not going to have a great interest in any kind of a formal proceeding, but there is one situation where the obligee may have an interest, and that would be if the child support agency chooses a health insurance plan under the terms of the statute, then certainly the obligee should have the right to challenge that choice. And finally, the provision in Section 10 that deals with liability and penalties for failure to honor the medical support notice addresses the plan administrator, and we believe that it should include the employer as well, because the failure may not be a failure on the part of the plan administrator. It may be a failure on the part of the employer, and it would be important to have teeth to enforce against a recalcitrant employer as well. Thank you for considering these comments. I'm open to any questions you have.
Fine. Have you had an opportunity to discuss your concerns with Ms. Shankel before today?
Vice Chair Ackerman, we spoke briefly this morning. It was kind of a rush situation where we didn't find out that this was up for a hearing until this morning.
Okay, so I think there's some opportunity for you to confer and come back, but I didn't want to preempt any questioning by the members of the committee, so I'll come back to that in my concluding remarks. Questions from the committee? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Berkowitz, you mentioned in Section 8 of your comments on page 3, maybe? Yeah, 3.
Yeah.
With regards to the Federal Consumer Credit Protection Act limits, and that the federal limit is 65%, and in Oregon it's currently 50%. What is that 50% of?
Vice Chair Ackerman, Representative Crummell, that's 50% of the disposable income, the net income.
So, follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. So what that means is that if an obligor makes $1,000 a month, then they could be obligated to pay up to $650 a month in child support and by combining it, child support and medical insurance. Am I hearing that correctly?
Vice Chair Ackerman, Representative Crummell, if the take-home pay, if the income after required withholding is $1,000 a month under the Federal Consumer Credit Protection Act, depending on the existence of other dependents and how far in arrears that person is, it could be as much as $650 withheld. Now, one of the things that's not clear in the statute, the way it's drafted, is whether each order is separately subject to that 65% limit, or whether the two orders combined are subject to that limit. And that's the clarification we're seeking.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Parker.
I have on the number 7 on your sheet there, you talked about the obligation, not the enforcing agency, should have the right to choose a plan if there are multiple plans available. I don't know how that would work. I mean, you may have, if I'm employed, I may have a range of plans, and then, of course, I have a budget that I'm working on, so then the ex-wife says she wants, assuming we're not getting along to a point where we're more worried about the kid than each other, but so if I say, well, I can provide the basic, but I'm not going to pay for over the top because I got the new girlfriend in the boat, so that, and you're saying the wife who has the child should be able to pick that plan.
Vice Chair Ackerman, Representative Barker, the way the bill is drafted now, it's the child support agency that's going to pick the plan. I assume that the child support agency will issue administrative rules to determine how that decision is made and what criteria will be followed. But assuming there are multiple plans available that come within the reasonable cost and accessibility requirements, I believe that it should be the custodial parent that chooses the plan, because obviously there are differences in the quality of the care and the convenience to the party. So if it's between the agency and the custodial parent, I'd rather see the custodial parent make that decision. And I'm assuming here, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Schenkel, that the agency will be issuing administrative rules to determine how that decision can be made. Obviously, we don't want to impoverish the obligated parent either.
Further questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I noticed that in Section 10, and I'll direct this question to Ms. Schenkel, Section 10, there are civil penalties, and if I'm reading them correctly, there are two types of penalties that could attach to the plan that receives an order. There is the obligation to pay the medical expenses that the child is entitled to, and in addition, for a knowing failure to implement, there's a fine not to exceed $100 for each failure. The does that conform with federal law? Is that a requirement for federal law, or is it something that is being developed as part of this package, or it's not necessarily part of a coordination issue?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson, I will note, first of all, in my testimony on that section, that we are currently in discussion with representatives from the Bureau of Labor and Industries about improving this language in this particular section. Having said that, this language is partially modeled after the direction of the federal regulation, but it is different than existing law. Existing law basically puts the liability on the obligated parent and not on the employer. But because this law will shift that enforcement burden, if you will, to the employer and the health plan administrator, it's also shifting the liability provisions, if I have answered your question.
You have, although I have a follow-up. Mm-hmm. If I could. This would appear to be a departure from the way this area of the law has worked in the past, which is that the employer and its plan are obligated to pay the benefits, but they're otherwise the burden stops there. That is, that this has, and it then goes a step further, which is to impose a specific civil sanction for failure to comply. Do the changes that are under discussion with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, would they modify that basic feature? That is, would they back away from a civil penalty feature?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson, I believe they would, but only to a degree. And I would be happy to have comments from you or to circle back with some specific suggested language, because we definitely do not have expertise in this area, and we're looking to the Bureau of Labor and Industries to give us some directions so that we're not recreating the wheel but are modeling it after existing remedies. The only piece is which I have already mentioned, which is the shift that the responsibility is now on the employer to make sure that the enrollment takes place, and so that shift will presumably stay in the law.
law for the burden being against the employer, but as to the remedies available, we are looking at amending that part.
Okay.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Hearing none, it would be the vice chair's position that perhaps you should confer, and I'll adjourn the public hearing, and when we re-adjourn, perhaps you can tell us what differences you have to see if it will provoke further questions and potential amendments. Question from the audience? Other witness, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Just for the record, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, and I won't take any of your time this afternoon, only to say that we've also only begun to analyze this bill and conferred with the Attorney General's office, and we'll work in partnership with them to work out any details in the, that deal with health plans and the availability of the insurance part.
That's fine. We will then adjourn public hearing and revisit this issue at another time. I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2112. Again, I think we call upon Ms. Schenkel.
Members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support, here today in support of House Bill 2112. There are several handouts coming to you on this bill. In relationship to the last bill, it's much shorter, one page only, but you will be getting more supporting documents. And don't let the length of the bill cause you to underestimate the impact. This is another federal mandate compliance issue for the child support program that we're here to talk about today. Basically, House Bill 2112 is in a series of bills that have come before the legislators dating back to 1995, in fact, 1993 in Oregon, and a series of amendments throughout the years. In 1997, when the Oregon Child Support Program enacted the child support provisions of welfare reform, that is when we really began to mirror our state laws in Chapter 25. With regard to the life welfare reform brought to Oregon, although we already had license suspension remedies available, was the requirement and the ability for us to have a program in place that allows us to suspend the license for any occupational or professional license, any recreational license, any driver's license, both regular permits and commercial. It's the whole spectrum. One of the things that occurred in 1997, quite honestly, that was a large 200-and-some-page bill, and in all of the discussion about all of the technical language, we missed the word driver. And therefore, technically, if you read the law today, while it's clear with regard to these specific provisions in 25785, which is not about the suspension itself, but is simply about gathering Social Security numbers on the application for the license, we missed the word driver, so there is only a requirement to gather on commercial license applications and not regular license applications. Technically, the federal government requires us to have a law in place that says the licensing agency will collect Social Security numbers for both or for all types. The federal government has said to the Oregon Child Support Program, you must fix it now. We have waited, as I have noted, since 1997 to bring this before you for a variety of reasons. We were still implementing the provisions in 1999. In 2001, some of you will remember that the implementation of the recreational licenses was quite a heated topic, and we focused on that and some remedies in Oregon for those types of licenses. It just never felt like the correct time to bring forward
forward this piece. Why? Because we have a successful license suspension program in Oregon. We do have the ability, and we do, as you will see on the statistics on the back of your testimony, suspend driver's licenses on a regular basis in partnership with the Department of Motor Vehicles. However, our law does not say that they will gather Social Security numbers on their applications, and we must do so. Also in your materials, you will see that we are actually, the state of Oregon is actually under federal notice of intent, that if we don't fix this law, we are subject to the loss of significant federal funding. Again, you have the one-page handout about how that impact would look in Oregon should we not have the ability to pass the law this session. Let me tell you briefly how we use Social Security numbers as well, because this is a very political topic, a very sensitive topic to many legislators and many of our customers as well. This is not a tool that the Child Support Program will be using to gather Social Security numbers. It's not as if we want DMV to gather them so we can then turn around and get them. The majority of the time, the vast majority of the time, the Child Support Program already has a Social Security number on file for our customers. The way we use Social Security numbers in our license suspension process is as a secondary identifier. So we have a case that qualifies, the arrears qualify for us to look at license suspension as a remedy. We do a data match with one of our partner agencies, such as DMV. We find out there is a driver's license, and we begin the legal process. And again, there is a legal process with opportunity to be heard to that obligated parent and to the licensing agency to say that we are beginning the process of suspension. Should we have a customer, an obligor with a very generic name, a very common name, and should we have two of those people that happen to be born in the same month and same year, we would like to have that Social Security number as a final identifier to make sure that we truly suspend, or cause DMV to suspend more accurately, the correct license for the correct obligor, so that we do not inadvertently suspend the license of some unknowing and uninvolved person. That is the intent of gathering Social Security numbers on the application. There are actually two pieces being changed, even though there is not a lot of language. You'll notice on line 10 of the bill, another piece that we're changing, not because we have to, but we think it is appropriate to do so. Again, in 1997, in that large bill, we ended up proposing, and it was passed by the Legislative Assembly, that the licensing agencies will gather, capture the Social Security numbers in their automated databases. The language you see in this bill is the federal language, and it says only to the maximum extent feasible. So we feel it is appropriate to adjust Oregon's law so it is not a mandate to our partner agencies that they put Social Security numbers in their databases, but that to the maximum extent feasible they shall do so. There are many licensing agencies, some much smaller than others, and they may not have the ability to have an automated database. So that is the second provision. It is the first piece that is the federal mandate compliance issue for us. So I will leave it with those introductory comments again, and be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Rozanski.
Mr. Chair, I've got, I guess, 2 points I wanted to bring up. This bill, does it actually require DMV from anyone that is getting a license, either new or renewed, to provide that information once this bill was in effect?
Vice Chair Ackerman, Representative Rozanski, yes, that is my understanding. That would be all new and renewals.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the thing that I find kind of interesting is that I attempted to pass legislation back, I believe it was probably 97, that required individuals that were stopped by police to provide their Social Security number as a base of identification. And we had a quite heated discussion about it, and it did not pass because, as some other members talked and we discussed it, there's supposed to be a prohibition of using your Social Security number for identification purposes. Mm-hmm. Now we're in this catch-22. It seems like now the federal government's saying that we have to do this, or we're going to potentially lose some type of funding. And I'm wondering if the department has any reasons why the federal agencies are now taking a position where they said that Social Security numbers aren't supposed to be used for identification purposes, are now basically mandating it to be captured for that intent.
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Prozanski, I think you're referring to the Privacy Act and the assistant attorney generals that are assigned to each of the individual licensing agencies most definitely have worked with those agencies about that very piece of law. This is not a directive in the child support regulations by the federal government saying that they are overriding that act. They are not requiring that the Social Security number be gathered and used as a primary identifier, nor are they saying it would be, for instance, your identifier on the driver's license itself. They are simply instructing the states to gather them on the applications so they are available as a secondary identifier, although that term is a term we use in Oregon, secondary identifier. But I do not think the intent is to override that act, and the attorneys within the Department of Justice work very closely with the licensing agencies that they advise to keep those two issues separate, to make sure that appropriate notice is given to the customers about whether you do or do not provide Social Security numbers, and more importantly in this instance, why you're providing it and what it will be used for. I might add, if I may, that you'll notice on my testimony there is a section on amendments, and the Department of Motor Vehicles would like to have an amendment on this bill, and we are open to that and are working with them, that they would like in their laws to reflect some updated language that if they're going to be gathering Social Security numbers, they want to be clear how that plays out in their privacy and their records requests. And so they are striving to have an amendment added to this bill, and I did not mention that earlier.
Go ahead.
Do you know whether or not if an individual customer went to renew their license or get a license, if they refused to provide that information, they would be denied that license?
Vice Chair Ackerman and Representative Prozanski, that is not the position of the Child Support Program. However, I do not know what legal counsel has advised, if anything, to DMV on that specific topic. I do know that other licensing agencies, for instance, on recreational licenses, that question came up because it's very common that a point-of-sale vendor for a recreational, for a fishing license, might be a clerk at G.I. Joe's. And when they asked that question, the information that I believe they were provided was, this isn't the intent that you have to figure out and verify every Social Security number. If you are given an obviously bogus number, 99999, you should question that and not perhaps accept that application. Or if they insist that they don't have one, you might want to ask some follow-up questions. But the intent is not to bar the license, but simply to gather the information whenever possible.
Go ahead. I'm wondering if we can get more clarity on that, because what I just heard is that it seems like that you are going to require it. I mean, the thing is, I remember Representative Wells sitting in this room basically pulling out his Social Security card, basically reading off of it or the information that came with it that said this is not to be used for the purpose of identification. And I think it's important before we move on something like this, we understand exactly what constituents may be faced with if they decide not to provide that information, if they're going to be at risk of not getting a driver's license renewed.
Vice Chair Ackerman, Representative Prozanski, I'd be happy to follow up with you and get some additional information from our AAGs. Absolutely.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious about a couple of things. One is that since the media and some of the folks in law enforcement have been telling us that identity theft is one of the greatest problems that a person can encounter, and trying to get it straightened out is a real can become a real disaster. And one of the methods that the thieves of identity utilize is the Social Security number. What steps is the department and the various departments, as well as the federal government, going to take to ensure that identity thieves can't break into a computer server that has the automated database and steal Social Security numbers? You may recall approximately 2 weeks ago when the Tri-West Insurance Company was broken into and 596,000 or something like that of our troops' medical records are at risk because of identity thieves breaking in.
Mr. Ackerman, Representative Crummell, that is a very serious issue. I agree. Briefly, for Child Support Program records, it is true that the majority of our records are on an automated database. It's referred to as CSIS. It's the Child Support Enforcement Automated System, which is another federal requirement that we must have an automated database. Within those records, Social Security number is one of the pieces of information that is held very confidential and is not released even to the parties other than in those specific court circumstances where statistical information must be provided But even given those laws, there are claim of risk and some safety disclosure exceptions available. So with regard to whether or not we would release that information, it would not be released by a worker. Having said that, of course, any computerized system, as I understand it, is subject to some hacker somewhere getting in. We do have rather extensive firewalls, I guess is the term, and I could get more information for you. But the automated system itself for child support is a mainframe here in Oregon. And in fact, there will be another bill that I believe comes before this committee next week about the confidentiality of child support program records. It's not targeted to automation, but about our records in general and who we do and don't share them with. With response to DMV, I think that goes partially to the amendment that they're seeking about whether or not they would disclose and what instances of Social Security numbers, and I don't know if Mr. Taylor passed out our proposed draft language, but Kelly Taylor is here and available to answer questions if you'd like to know more about what DMV would intend to do.
Okay. Members of the committee, I have another commitment at 3 o'clock before another committee. I don't want to rush this. However, it's the intention of the Vice Chair to continue this public hearing so that these matters can be addressed at another time. Further issues with Ms. Shankle at this time. Otherwise, I will adjourn the public hearing to another date. Further business of the committee? Hearing none, the committee stands in adjournment. Thank you.